This is the Amateur Skeptics Podcast, number 326. I'm your host, Brian. Joining this evening is Mac.
Hey, everybody.
And the dumbass himself.
Life is like a porn movie. Write your own happy ending.
You know what? That is the best iteration of Life is Like a Box of Chocolates that I've heard so far.
What about people are like a box of chocolates? Yum.
Yeah, that's okay too, but I really like Life is like a porn movie. I like it.
Porn movie, they're like a box of chocolate, all melty all over each other, their goo spilling out. No?
I think you should have stopped while you were ahead. how are we all doing this evening?
I'm doing pretty good.
Functional.
Functional is, you know, reasonable. I'm getting ready to do the eclipse. So next on Monday, April 8th. Monday, April 8th, I think it's like 9 or 10 in the morning. I will be somewhere where I should be able to...
sacrificing a virgin to a volcano.
Yep. But the only problem is that the place where I'm going right now, Granger Lake, right now it says it's going to be raining and thundering. And so, I don't know. I don't know. I'm going nonetheless, you know, it'll at least get dark during the day, but I'm not going to be able to see the corona if the weather doesn't clear up. So right now it does not look promising, but I'm still going, damn it.
Well, good luck.
Thank you. I'm pretty excited. Where I am, I should, if you know, all things go well, 2.5 minutes of darkness. Yeah. Mm. Looking forward to that. Anything else fun going on?
Oh, not too much with me. I had a good show because I mentioned last episode that my improv group was having a show, and it went great. It was sold out, lots of laughs. Everybody enjoyed it.
That's great.
Yes, and?
I like that kind of communal theater because where the audience gets to be part of the experience. I think that it can be a lot of fun.
Definitely. And especially when you've got we did it in a pub, which we had table seating, so people were enjoying meals as they watched and just standing up on stage and getting laughs and everybody having a lot of fun. It's a lot better experience, I find, than a lot of improv shows where you're just in some sort of auditorium and doing stuff.
So I've done both, or at least I've gone to both. And I kind of think that there's something to that. I used to do lighting for an improv group, and it was in a theater, and a lot of people came to see it. It was a lot of fun. But yeah, there's something. I think we've also done it at the Comedy Works. I went to one, and that was maybe a little better because you had food and drinks and stuff like that. I do think that maybe that's a little better. So yeah,
I do like the atmosphere of that and the kind of comedy club atmosphere of places. I'm not sure if people still do comedy club things anymore, but I know that at bars they still do often have comedy nights and stuff. And that's just like sitting down for a meal and enjoying a show is a really good experience, I think.
I want to go to some open – I think it'd be fun to go to some open mic and just, you know, just listen to people getting started and see what they're doing. Mm. I think that might be fun. I don't know if I want to do it, but maybe if I saw some other people failing, then I'd feel better about failing up there too.
You know, Brian,
go ahead.
The thing about the open mic nights is you've got to watch out and make sure that it's just a comedy show and not an autopsy.
Yeah, right. All right.
I went to one of those to support a friend doing stand-up comedy for the first time, and it was fun. It was a much smaller place, too, and so like a lot of audience interaction, so people were just free to yell up stuff where they want, so I was there, like, just yelling out smart-alky stuff the entire night, and one of the comedians called me, Sex Dungeon Peter Griffin.
Nice. that's good. All right, well, good. Yeah, I'm glad that went well.
Yep.
All right, well, if there's nothing else, you know what time it is.
That's right. It's time for the dumbass and, I guess, in memorandum of him having left the show, Ian's masturbation moment, brought to you by the mighty, all-encompassing Dumbass Media Empire.
The Amateur Skeptics present Ian's Masturbation Moment, brought to you by the Dumbass Media Empire. the Dumbass Media Empire, bringing you content that touches people while they touch themselves.
All right.
That's right.
So you're gonna tell us about
secretly.
whether you should masturbate to get rid of that headache or not.
That's right.
This is certainly, I mean, something you've heard colloquially, right? I mean, it's a kind of an old wives' tale. I mean, people talk about, you know, this is certainly something that I've heard over the years, right? That if you have a headache, having sex, and they always said sex, of course, but masturbating, alrighty, you know, could help with that. And so what do you got?
I haven't heard of that, which is strange because I have heard a lot of jokes about how the woman always gets out of sex by complaining about having a headache.
Yeah, and I swear that I remember hearing that it was, you know, that sex was good for, you know, getting rid of a headache.
So yeah, that should be a pretty obvious comeback then. Well, you know, it's good for headaches, dear.
Exactly, I mean, that was always the thing to me, is that that's kind of funny. Well, I mean, that's exactly why you should be having sex. But, that's why you hear that she has to wash her hair, like that takes all night.
Right. Yeah, but there, more than just being an old wives' tale, there is actually scientific evidence to conclude that masturbation or sex can help with headaches. This is from Amanda Ellison, PhD professor at Durham University in the UK. She's the author of the book Splitting: The Inside Story on Headaches. So like your brain releases chemicals that serve as natural painkillers. And we all know about the main thing being dopamine, of course, the reward hormone, but there's also oxytocin in there, which they call the bonding hormones, neurochemicals that stop pain, stop basically your sensation of pain in your body, in a similar way to how opioids work.
Right, but here's the problem I have with this whole thing. Is it pain, or is it orgasm, or is it arousal that's producing these chemicals?
You know, probably arousal is also producing the chemicals. So, like, I don't know. I suppose it's a combination of a lot of factors, and I guess we can't really say that masturbation or sex is a certain cure-all for hangovers, just something that could possibly help, because like the way the chemicals interact in your body can be different for different people, and also just a lot of people will find it hard to get into the mood to do sexual stuff while they're in pain.
Yeah, while they have a headache. I just would say anecdotally that I think that when I'm aroused, I have a higher pain tolerance.
That's possibly true. I think I've heard about experiments that cover similar areas. I don't think I've seen one involving pain, but it wouldn't surprise me if a pain tolerance study of that sort existed.
I see a few different things when I Googled it, but it'll be interesting. We can put it into a later podcast and maybe dive into that just a little bit more. But it just makes me think that at the point of orgasm, that these chemicals will end, right? That you'll get the whatever burst you get from orgasm. But then how quickly do they diminish afterwards? And that during arousal, maybe they would stay around longer.
Mm.
I think that would be interesting to know.
Like, yeah, maybe like, it could be. That's one of the things that I don't think it's actually being studied, but it could be a thing where like there might be a best technique for using sexual activity to cure a headache. It could be a thing, you know, like, yeah, it might need a little time too. Maybe it'll require a bit of edging in order to keep the hormone levels up for a certain amount of time, you know?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Apparently, masturbation can also stimulate the parasympathetic branch of the vagus nerve.
Okay.
Which promotes rest and digesting kind of processing. Has a role in heart rate and stuff like that. So, you know, something like that can, you know, add towards the pain relief and relaxation level that you're going for with this.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And I get, And I don't think this article gets into it, but I guess, you know, it talks about migraines, but, I mean, stress headaches versus other types of headaches. I guess what's causing the headache could make a big difference whether or not this method would help.
Right, yeah. So, with regards to migraines and how blood vessels become dilated, masturbation can play a preventative role in that. But, this is just more of a preventative thing that, in theory, that days before a migraine, your neurochemicals can be out of balance, which can lead to that. So, like, masturbation might be a way to, like, bring that more into balance with the way that works.
Yeah, I guess for severe migraines, I mean, there's a lot of things going on there. I've certainly have had migraines, but I've never had one that was so severe that, you know, that I don't think, like, a little Advil or something help, you know, it certainly could help me take care of it. But I think for some people that doesn't work. I've heard morphine injections, I think, it's stuff that's been used. So I'm wondering, you know, how the inclusion of, you know, sex and masturbation, how that might affect, you know, somebody with like really severe migraines.
Well, there was a cohort study that was made by Dr. Evers here, which is the largest cohort study on how sexual activity can help with migraine and cluster headaches.
It looks like it also included blood pressure, high blood pressure, and an increased heart rate.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so.
But, according to this study, 60% reported an improvement in symptoms. 70% of those getting moderate or complete relief. So it's possibly something to try if you're experiencing migraine headaches.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. I mean, 50% is a lot. It says, no, in this study, migraine patient studies who had sexual activity, 60% reported improvement in symptoms.
Right.
And of 70% of those getting, where yes. did the 50% come in?
Did I say 50%?
There's something on there that says 50%. 50% of them say the symptoms worse. 50% say symptoms worsened after sex.
It does say here that in some patients, sexual activity like masturbation could cause headaches or make them worse. He said that when we found when we tested these patients that how their blood vessels increased or decreased in diameter was not in the normal range. So they'd have problems in vasodilation, vasoconstriction. And then if they increased sexual activity, their vessels remained more dilated, bringing them some pain.
That's interesting too, isn't it?
Yeah. So, like, it's not deeply understood how this pain works, but it apparently happens in younger men and in women in their 50s.
I would say that I've experienced something similar to this. You know, if I had a high headache and then after sex, I mean, during sex, I might not notice the headache or it might feel better. And then after orgasm, then the headache might come back.
Apparently, 1% of the world's population approximately gets sex headaches.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad that's not me.
Yeah. So, that would be pretty, I guess you'd want to just avoid anything arousing in that case.
Or once again, maybe arousal would help and orgasm is the problem. I think there's a lot of questions here. At least I have a lot of questions.
Yeah, there's a lot more research to be done, too, about exactly how this could work and how sexual activity could ease the pain of headaches, but, you know, it has a solid foundation in what we know about neurochemicals and how the brain works, that this could be something that might help people with headaches.
I really like this idea. See, so it's not just for having babies. It's for headache.
Not at all.
It's for headaches.
You got a pounding headache? Go in and pound yourself.
So, but then this next part says that it could make it worse, right? So there are some. Oh, okay. This is where you got the 1% of the population. Okay.
Yeah.
So they suggested here that maybe it'd be better for some people to use a weighted blanket and watch Ted Lasso. That's oddly specific.
But I thought you were supposed to be avoiding.
Go ahead, Mike.
I thought you were supposed to be avoiding things that were arousing.
That Ted Lasso man, whoo, he is sexy.
Yeah, that's my fetish.
Yeah, that's one of them. What else we got?
I think masturbation, amateur skeptic, thumbs up recommendation to try if you can, if it's worthwhile to try and get rid of a headache.
I think that, you know, remember we had the one about the guy that is trying to beat the Guinness Book of World Records for masturbating. Now we know why he was doing it. He had a headache.
Must be it.
Must be it. It's interesting, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And it, I guess it's just talking to your doctor about, you know, masturbation for headaches. There you go.
Okay.
Should we bring back the woolly mammoth? Not a euphemism for masturbating this time, but really, I'm talking about the woolly mammoth.
I want to ride a woolly mammoth.
Do you?
Yeah, bring him back. Put out zoos of them. Give everybody mammoth rides.
So there's been, I mean, these articles come up constantly in my feed read, you know, for you know, about this company called Colossus that had said that by 2027 that it would be able to bring back the woolly mammoth, right? De-extinct the woolly mammoth.
So where's the woolly mammoth going to live when it's de-extinct?
Okay, so I mean that's like the first question. What are we going to do with these huge creatures? Well, they say they're going to populate the Arctic. That's their plan, and they say that this will be their idea is, I think that there's a lot of unknowns here. But
so what are they going to displace when they populate the Arctic?
Well, I don't know. I mean, which Arctic are we talking about? You know, are we talking about Alaska? Or are we talking about, you know, the Arctic where there's like penguins?
Well, that would be Antarctic.
Antarctic, right? Yeah. So I'm not sure exactly what this means, but they think that it can help with climate change. And I was looking here for what they said about climate change. Maybe it's not in this particular article, but so here's the thing. Here's the rub. They're using an Asian elephant, which they say right now is 99.6% match for the mammoth DNA. So they're essentially going to use and they've got a technique that they're using, and which sounds really cool. The technique sounds cool. This article doesn't have everything. Let me look at another article. And there are tons of them because they keep coming out. So whatever the technique they're going to use, it's called IPSPC, is a single cell procedure that offers access to every other type of cell in the body. This would potentially allow the creation of sperm and egg as well. But of course, the basis that they're going to start with is the African elephant.
Mm.
Or no, I'm sorry, the Asian elephant. So a little bit smaller, I guess, smaller elephant.
Okay, and, so yeah. Here's a really important question.
Yep.
So when they start impregnating these Asian elephants with woolly mammoths, who's going to deal with the fallout when the Asian elephants' husbands see them giving birth to woolly mammoths and they're going to wonder where they came from?
Yeah, that seems like a potential problem, doesn't it?
It's a huge problem.
So there's a couple of other things that bother me with this. So, I mean, the science here may very well be sound. I mean, it's certainly, and one of the things that they said, of course, that this is going to be, of course, not an actual woolly mammoth, right? Because they are still mixing it with the Asian elephant's DNA. And so what do they say that it's
It's a chimera.
Well, it is a chimera. Yeah, exactly. That's not what they said, but yes. it's kind of true. It's in the article. But either way, I mean, they recognize that it's not, you know, that it's not. But then they say, that they're going to put them in the Arctic. And my question is that legal? is it legal to just create a bunch of large primates and then populate a continent or some other area, you know, and to reintroduce these things? I
don't think they're primates.
No, I'm not primates. I'm sorry, mammals. I meant mammals. Just mammals. Yeah, they're not primates.
Okay. Side note: did you know that you can not make a possum stew, but you can make it in a thin broth, and that's because they're marsupials.
Ugh. I really question the ethics here. In the legalities of some of this.
It's a pretty idea. It's a beautiful idea, and people are going to like the idea. I question, you know, it's not. There's a reason why woolly mammoths don't exist anymore.
There's a.
I don't understand how it's supposed to be beneficial to the ecology, how it's supposed to be like beneficial.
That's
it. Because like we've got polar bears who are like in under stress.
Yep.
Because of what's happening to the Arctic, we're gonna put another animal in there to be under stress because of that.
Yeah, and so there's an kind of an offhanded comment somewhere in the article, in one of these articles, about how they think it's going to be here. Is this it? Let's see. There are many who have ethical reservations about the project. I would be included in that. The age-old question of whether or not you should do something just because you can. Ecologist and conservationist biologist Doug McCleary, anyway, says that we have no business introducing what is essentially a new species into the Arctic. And that's the thing, is that they do recognize somewhere, it says somewhere in here that they recognize that this isn't a woolly mammoth, that this is a new species, and like Mac liked to call it a chimera.
Yeah, and it's also an invasive species.
Well, I mean, you'd think that it would be if we introduced it into the Arctic, right? Because it doesn't belong there anymore.
It didn't grow there, so it doesn't belong there, yeah.
Go ahead.
If you put it in there, what's it going to displace?
I think that's a really good question.
What chain of ecology, what chain of predators and prey is it going to break that's going to cause damage to something else?
Yeah, it says the mammoths originally populated parts of the Arctic. These new beings will be functionally mammoths and not a direct genetic match for the species that went extinct. And I was trying to see what they said. They think because of climate change that the mammoths will be able to help with something.
That doesn't really help me understand the situation anymore.
It didn't help me either, yeah, but that's what they said, right? I don't know that none of these articles that I've seen really explore that piece of it, and I think is dubious.
They have a better chance of doing something constructive by bringing back the dodo.
Okay, so that's where I was going to go.
Sorry, go ahead.
I said that's exactly what that was going to be my point, is bring back the dodo.
Yeah, at least it's a smaller species, and it has a niche that it went into.
You know, I remember hearing back in the 90s, I think it was, that they had plans to try to bring back the Tasmanian tiger.
That's another one that's in the works.
They're still working on that.
Yeah.
I know they have some, like, preserved embryos from long ago that they were working with. So, like, I don't know what roadblocks they've run into with that. According to the hype when I heard about it, I figured that we'd have Tasmanian tigers by now, but nope.
So that's the Tasmanian tiger's an interesting one, because there are some people who think that species may still be around in its range somewhere, and I guess it's possible, but I think it's unlikely. But there's a lot of people that disagree with me on that. And it's possible that it could, that there still could be live Tasmanian tigers out there.
Yeah, well, it's also possible there could be ivory-billed woodpeckers out there. But
yeah, I don't think so.
People seem to think not.
I think less that's likely that species is still around than that. I would give a much higher percentage, or more likelihood of the Tasmanian tiger still being in its range than the ivory-billed woodpecker. I think it's gone.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, the ivory-billed woodpecker, the Tasmanian tiger, the dodo, they are evidence of why we can't have nice things.
Well, they are. And here's the other thing, is that when we're talking about those species, like the dodo, I don't know if we could put it back into the ecology that it came from, but it's a small enough animal that we could potentially keep it comfortably in a zoo. It's hard to do that even with elephants. Even right now, elephants don't necessarily do well in zoos. They certainly don't do well in circuses, right? And at least that practice has finally stopped in the U.S. But
at least not the ones with really large ears, right?
Yeah, my understanding of the dodos is that they were very docile birds.
You could potentially introduce dodo to aviculture.
Sure. I think that you could do that without destroying, a whole ecology. I'm not convinced you can do that with the woolly mammoth.
I think they have a better chance of actually creating something useful if they go with my plan and they go ahead and modify the chickens into the first velociraptor.
Nice. Yeah. But and here's the thing is that the other thing is that the Tasmanian tiger, we could de-extinct that one and put it back into the ecology in which it came from, you know, that we, because essentially, you know, hunted it to extinction in. And it would, and we probably wouldn't displace anything at this point, right? The mallet's been gone a lot longer.
So,
what you just said, though, just as a small minor correction, that a chicken-sized velociraptor would actually just be a regular velociraptor. They were really that small.
That's true. They are that small.
If you want
but I'm specific in saying purse velociraptors, as in they should be trained to. They should be trained to ride around in purses.
Those would be teacup velociraptors.
Young women, you know, make young ladies look smart.
Wouldn't that be a teacup velociraptor at that point?
Could be.
Paris Hilton will need one.
Yep.
Well, I think what you really want to go for, if you want like the mean, more Jurassic Park looking ones, would be the Deinonychus.
That's the one. That's what it's based off of. Yeah.
Yep.
I'd be fine with just a velociraptor.
I remember Deinonychus. He led a velociraptor revolt against Rome.
That's right. He's the one that said, and everybody was like, "I'm Deinonychus."
No, but you guys know that there are incidences of animals de-extincting themselves, right?
So I have heard some stories. Can you give us an example?
I read one just recently.
There was an article. There was a whole article that talked about three of them, right? Uh oh.
Bad cat's here.
Yeah.
With a careless whisper.
Well, that's an entrance.
There was a tortoise that basically evolved into what had been on the island before.
Oh, okay. So
there was also a bird that evolved from a flying bird into a non-flying bird on this one atoll after it had gone extinct on the atoll. The ancestor of that bird started basically evolving back into the bird.
Yeah, I think that, Mac, that would be a good article for you to seek out to put in our next podcast.
I'll find it.
Yeah, do that. Anyway, I'm not so sure that to bring back the woolly mammoth. I think I'm with Mac. Do something like the dodo, maybe the Tasmanian tiger, something like that. Makes a
personal
lot more sense.
Velociraptor.
No.
Velociraptor first?
The raptor first.
Nope. First velociraptor.
If they're any smarter than a tegu, then I think that's trouble.
Ah, yeah.
Smarter than a tegu?
Tegus are pretty smart. They're pretty smart. Tegus are.
Yep. I'm told they are. Yes.
Yep. Anyway.
So
I don't know. I just really want to Jurassic Park in real life. I don't care if the dinosaurs take over. I want it.
Fair enough.
That's not surprising.
Yeah, but there's some unrealistic parts of that movie. Like she ran around in the jungle in high heels.
Hey, Mac, why don't you tell us about how the monk parakeet got to Texas?
We're doing more invasive species.
Yeah,
okay.
We're doing more invasive.
So the monk parakeet, first of all, the monk parakeet is fucking everywhere.
They're pretty successful. They're pretty successful. And they do a lot of fucking. That's true.
They are successful because they are fucking everywhere.
Yeah, that's what I
figured. They do kung fu, right?
Dumbass, I'm sorry.
I said, and they do kung fu, right?
And they
birds do. Most birds practice fly chi.
Fly chi. It's pandas that do kung fu.
That's right. So the monk parakeet, also known as the Quaker parrot.
Yep.
And the article, the news broadcast, they kept referring to it as a parakeet. I don't think they realized that parakeet just means small parrot. So there's a lot of things that are parrots that are called parakeets.
You know, it's kind of...
It was a different species.
Yeah.
They kept referring to it as a parrot-like species. Right. And I'm like...
It is a parrot. Yeah.
It is a parrot.
They got that wrong.
It is a citizen.
Yeah. Yeah.
But...
it was there before them.
So anyway, this article was all about trying to deconstruct how the Quaker parrot, the monk parakeet, got to Texas in the first place. And they talked about a release of them at JFK Airport in New York. And we still have Quaker parrots up in upstate New York.
Okay.
They are living happily and, you know, they're doing just fine. We've also got Quaker parrots in Hyde Park in Chicago, and Chicagoans love them. They think they're lucky. But, you know, essentially we've got Quaker parrots in a lot of different places, and they may have all come from this one release, but more likely they came from a bunch of releases.
Yeah, that's and that seems more likely to me. I think that they have some specifics as far as like releases, right? Some of the articles that I put in there has pointed to some specific events.
One of them mentioned to an intentional release.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
what are we talking about when we are talking about release here? Is like somebody like maybe is about to get caught at customs and lets the birds go or something? Or
more like you've got an accidental release is if you're carrying a truckload of them and the truck gets knocked over and the birds get out. Or you've got crates and the crates get dropped, birds get out, they fly all over the place. And intentional release is more like you've got, say, a pet store or a breeding farm full of these birds and you can't take care of them, they're not profiting you, you don't want to do it anymore, so you release them into the wild.
Which I think has happened a few times. They said specifically some monk parakeets released intentionally in what, the 2000s sometime? When was it,
Matt? 2004, I think it said.
Yeah.
And, so the thing about monk parakeets, Quaker parakeets, is that they've got some really, really strong survival strategies around nests. So they're surviving temperatures that they should not be able to survive because they basically make big colonies with elaborate nests.
Yeah, they're huddling together.
And they can share their warmth. And they will cooperate with each other. And they also tend to build their nests on warm things.
Yeah.
Famously on power line.
Yeah, that creates a lot of problems down here.
Yeah. And Texas doesn't need that help to have power.
No, we have enough problems already, right? The last thing we need is help from the monk parakeet.
Your power co-op takes care of that on their own. So you actually don't need the monk. You don't need the Quakers.
Yeah, no, we can screw that up all on our own. We don't need help. Yeah.
So, but I recently saw something about the fact that the Quaker parakeets are now spreading in Europe as well.
Yay!
I mean, the resilience of this bird is pretty amazing. I mean, the fact that they huddle together the way that they do, and they said that they can lose up to 30% of the colony in a bad winter. And I think even in that cold snap that we had down here, 2021 took out quite a few of them, but not enough to even take out the colonies. They're losing them.
They are breeding for losses.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. They're able to overcome that in their breeding strategies.
Which is basically just screw again.
They're fucking everywhere. I think we said that.
Yes.
Yep. But one of the things that always amazed me is, if you look up the taxonomy of the Quaker parrot, you look up where it is on the tree of life, there is not another bird on the same branch. There is not another bird that's related to it. It's basically its own thing.
Really? In the phylogeny, what is their closest relative?
Let me look it up real quick.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that. In their particular phylogeny, the branch, they're the only ones that left in the branch.
Or the only ones needed on the brand.
Well, that's two different things.
Well, think about it. Usually when you've got close species that are right together, they're specializing for some environment. So they may change their color, they may change their habits, they may change their genetics a little bit because they're adapting to some new condition.
Right.
Quaker parrots don't adapt that way. They adapt by using... They adapt by using strategies where they adapt the environment to their need.
More like humans, right? Exactly. The way that we've conquered all of these different, exactly. Places. Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it, Mac. Well, anyway, we don't need the phylogeny right at the moment. That is interesting. They have to have a closest relative. And interestingly enough, you know, this is not Texas's only native parakeet, because some have come up through Central America into here. And cherry crested conure or something like that?
Red crowned, parakeet or red crowned Amazon.
Okay.
But now understand here, don't misuse the word native though, because that one has been declared a native species in Texas, The Quaker Parrot is not.
No, no, that's what I'm saying. That okay, yeah, okay, that's true. That but here's the thing: is that they're calling them invasive, but even a native species can be invasive, right? I mean, it just depends on, you know, what they're doing to the ecology, and there's a lot of problems with the monk parakeets with the ecology.
Okay, so it looks like its only close relative is the cliff parakeet.
Okay. And where is that parakeet? Is that also a South American bird?
It is South American. They were originally considered to be the same species.
Okay.
The cliff parakeet's been elevated to species status, but
okay,
they also don't spread out like the Quakers do.
Okay.
Looks like the Quaker does have three subspecies though.
Okay.
Which I didn't know about.
None of that surprises me.
Looks like it's all about ranges.
Yeah, exactly. And that might be okay. And that's not uncommon too. What ranges they manage to live in, they speciate a little bit, you know, because of that, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And of course, I'm going to go ahead and finish off with the conservation status, which is
okay. Good.
Least concern. They're doing fine, folks.
Yeah.
Quakers are doing fine everywhere they live.
I think
Actually, I've talked before about the lovebirds also, right, in Arizona?
I think you have talked about that. I think that was just a couple months back.
There's wild lovebirds out in Arizona, wild West African peach-faced lovebirds that have basically taken up residence in Arizona. The environment is, it's comfortable for them. And what is interesting that I saw recently is apparently some of them are going back to people's houses. In other words, they're basically going, okay, I'm done with this wild thing. I'm going back home. I'm going to go find a person who's going to pick me up and take me back into their house.
Interesting. You know, it was interesting what they also said about the feeding habits of the monk parakeet, because what it does is that so during warmer times, it eats a lot of fruits and different stuff like that, and it can vary its diet. But in the winter, when it gets colder, they're relying on bird feeders because they switch back to seed. And they're saying that this was unique about this parrot. And I don't think that's true. I think that
I think
most
unique
parrots can do, have a very wide range of foods and stuff like that. It seemed like the people talking about that in that article that you put in there, they were not as informed about parrots as I would have liked. Specifically,
no,
they do sound like they're birders, but parrots were not their specialty.
They were also talking about how the
I'm sorry, dumbass.
They're just spouting off stuff. You're saying that they're just spouting off stuff that they heard mindlessly?
Probably.
Yes, they're probably mimicking.
Yep.
I'm saying that they were just a little bit uninformed about parrots, is what I'm saying.
They were talking on the broadcast about how the birds have adapted to, you know, going down to like 17 degrees centigrade. And I'm like, they adapt by strategizing.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's by grouping together, they can keep each other warm. But also, the way that they eat, listen, the way that they talked about their eating is not different than you know, my conure.
Right.
And so that's just parrots.
Conures and Quaker parrots, it pretty much is a matter of whatever comes within range of their beak.
Right.
Whether that be seed, fruit, or human flesh.
Okay, not giving it a little chin rub.
Well, you know, if they allow it, it's fine.
Yeah.
But if they don't allow it, they're going to eat your finger.
Yeah, probably.
So,
probably.
Yeah. It is pretty interesting how they've been able to adapt to these colder climates, right? Because they are considered, you know, a warmer climated, bird,
yeah.
but they have some strategies that allow them to successfully, in Texas is not the coldest place they live. I would think that Chicago would be colder.
And upstate New York.
Yeah. Those places would be colder. And Florida and Texas and places like that. I mean, does Florida must have the,
Florida. I used to work with somebody in Florida and she was talking about how she had a whole tree full of Quakers outside of her apartment. And I said, oh, that must be nice. She's like, it depends on what time of the day it is.
No, part of the thing that they say about the ecology is that how loud they are, right, is part
they
of the
are.
Problem. They are noisy. They said that they've been
they
able to
loud
scare off
and
squirrels.
They are chirpy.
Yeah. Squirrels have left places because of these birds. They've moved out because the their neighbors are so loud.
They are loud and they are chirpy.
Yeah, they're a noisy bird.
So it's got a, they've got a really, really sharp, really, really sharp sudden bark.
But they are beautiful. They are so cool.
Oh, they are beautiful birds, and they're really, really intelligent. Oh,
yeah. Yep.
Grouping together for warmth is the same strategy that penguins use to cope with the cold.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. So it's yep. Yeah. Pretty interesting. All right. And what do you? You got frogs with heart-shaped eyes, pupils. Heart-shaped pupils. What is going on there?
Right, yeah.
Nothing good, I would say.
Actually, this is kind of natural, and you can look this up. The pics are pretty weird, but yeah, this is something that they verified as true. It can happen. There can be some variety in frog pupils is the story behind this. The frogs that swim in the water tend to have round pupils. Then what you get is frogs can have like more elongated pupils and stuff. Let me just find the place here.
I think that, I mean, it's pretty common, depending on the time of day that they come out, whether that their pupils are round or more slitted. I think that that's also true in a lot of reptiles, right? Depending on the time of day that they come out, whether they're nocturnal or diurnal, will affect the pupil quite a bit.
The word I'm looking for is anurans, and this is the order comprising frogs, toads, and tree frogs exhibit the greatest diversity in pupil shape and size.
Okay.
Particularly, as I was saying here, and they've got a bunch of different pupil types shown on a grid here. This is like a huge diversity. There's a number of them are more round, but there are some that takes on a bunch of different shapes. And the heart shape, I don't think, if I understand this correctly, here is one down here. I don't think that it's like all frogs are the thing that have a heart shape. It's like kind of heart-like shape, but some will be closer to what we consider a heart than others.
Sure. I see hearts, I see diamonds, I see an umbrella, and I see a mustache.
And I see a manta ray.
So pupils can vary quite a bit more than I would have thought. Like,
aquatic environments, as I was saying, pupils are mostly circular, also those that burrow in the ground and stuff. But the ones that operate in a wide range of light levels, depending on where they move and how they have to cope with that, their pupils can get very distorted between species in a wide range of ways.
Do the ones that have the heart-shaped pupils, is it certain circumstances? Like, have they just fallen in love in a Warner Brothers cartoon?
I mean, I think clearly what is going on is that there is a female frog on stage, doing some sort of risque dance, and the frog is at the table, his eyes turn to hearts, and, his tongue rolls out of his mouth onto the floor, and it woo! And bangs on the table. No?
Well, I definitely want to see that.
I'm picturing that, except with a wolf.
Right, exactly. It is. Yeah. The eyes popping out and the wolf. Isn't that? Yeah.
That was in The Mask.
The Mask. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. So, yeah, this grid of all the different pupils, shapes, and sizes is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. We think the really weird, more elongated or blobby that pupils that can form these shapes have to do with their lifestyle, the way the way they experience light, and that we don't know exactly the reasons for each different one, but there are a lot of species and a lot of variation.
That's cool.
There's even frogs with eyes in their mouth. So what do we know?
Really,
eyes in their mouth, huh? There actually is a picture.
And I was thinking, look, he has his father's eyes. Gomez, take those out of his mouth.
Yeah, something like that.
Interesting. Let's stick with animals.
You also, Are you going to go with Snake Hunter?
I was going to go Snake Hunter since okay. I thought so originally I put this in here a while back and I was kind of thought that Mad Cat might be interested in this one.
Yeah, that's Mac too. I think that's one that Snake Bites or what is it?
The Snake Hunter. So Mark Snake Hunter. Pelly. Yeah, Pelly.
Brian Barczyk was in that.
In one of the he's not in one of the well he's not he might have gone to see him right because it wasn't he's in Australia is he not
anyway no, he's I think from Australia but he did go and he and this guy Chewy were in a few of the episodes a long time back
yeah so but what this gentleman does this we're not this this is a guy who this is the guy if you have a venomous snake in your backyard, this is who you call. So he's in Victoria, southeastern Australia, and I don't know. He probably has a YouTube following and stuff like that as well. I'm not. I thought I looked for it and didn't probably. See anything. But anyway, so he was. There's some videos on here because the videos are on his YouTube where him and his dog. He uses his dog sometimes to help him catch snakes. His dog is trained, his dog has been trained to deal with venomous snakes, right? So he knows how to stay out of their bite range and stuff like that. And so in some of the videos, you can kind of watch the dog helping him to just, distract the snake so that he can grab it safely. And so I think he's been doing this for a while. His daughter is the one that put up the articles, and this happened a couple weeks back where he had an equipment failure when he was dealing with one of these venomous snakes, and he got bit. It sounds like he had a gripper that he would use to hold the head, and then so he could grab it after that. Well, it broke, and the snake got him. Is what it sounds like. And I thought this article is kind of important because this is not a guy that he got bit, but not because he was doing anything unsafe necessarily, right? This is something that he had done many times. Go ahead.
It was an accident.
Yeah, it was an accident. It's something. Yeah. So I think it's important to highlight that. I mean, people go out and do stupid things with these things and get bit by snakes. Like, we've seen those preachers that put rattlesnakes in their sleeping bags and stuff like that, right? And eventually they end up getting bitten and dying. That's a thing that happens here in the U.S. And probably not just the U.S. where the snake handlers who think that Jesus will keep them from getting bitten because of some line in the Bible.
Or people who do the rattlesnake thing every year where they kill a certain amount of rattlesnakes.
Yeah, that's unfortunate too because I there's no reason to go out of your way to kill them. But yeah, so this happened a while back. I'm pretty sure that I read an update somewhere where he is recovering, but it was pretty serious.
Yeah, it says in the article that he's gotten some of his he's up on his feet and he's gotten his blood is almost back.
Yeah, but
getting back to these preachers that put rattlesnakes because Jesus is going to protect them.
Right.
How do they know that they're picking Christian rattlesnakes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I how do you know you're checking the right that they got the right faith on the rattlesnake? I guess that isn't clear.
You get
the devil has been known to take the form of a snake, right?
Well, yeah. I do think a Buddhist rattlesnake would probably leave well alone.
I take issue with that because they want this because of that line. They, the idea that the snake of the forked tongue is the liar, but in that scene in the Bible where the devil appears as a snake and talks to them everything he said was true. There was no lies. Yeah.
Also, that snake was not identified as the devil.
That's true.
Sure.
Because anybody who read their Gaiman and Pratchett knows that wasn't the devil. It was Crowley.
Either way. That snake was more truthful than God. Anyway, I thought this was interesting because I mean we need these types of people out there to help rescue these snakes, right? And because in Australia they're closer to the venomous snakes. It could happen to me. I guess I could end up with a a venomous snake in my backyard. I live close enough, you know, to areas where they live, where I could have a copperhead or something like that in the backyard. And you need people to come and get them safely, right? We shouldn't have to kill these snakes every time something, you know, they end up somewhere where they shouldn't. And so it's unfortunate.
There's no such thing as absolute safety, especially, I guess, if you're someone who works with dangerous animals in Australia.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it seems to me that, I mean, he's done this a lot, but maybe bite gloves or something, you know, maybe would be a good addition to.
I think that the lesson here is that if you're working with dangerous creatures, particularly in Australia, don't add the suffix hunter after your name, or accidents will happen.
Well, I'm not sure that's it. The one good thing about Australia is that if they can't identify the snake right away, their antivenom that they have will work for any snake bite, right? And then they can target it, so they can at least get you started. Unlike here in the U.S., where we have a much bigger mix of types of venom, you know, in species and stuff like that. So,
yeah, and you have to make sure you've got the snake that bit you, and you have to make sure that the snake wasn't rabid.
I think that in Australia, I think they all have a neurotoxic venom. And in the U.S., we rattlesnakes have a hemotoxic, and maybe we also have snakes that have a neurotoxic. So you've got to know specifically the species, you know, that you got bit by is more important.
There's a lot of things down in Australia that are neurotoxic, though. Blue-ringed octopus is neurotoxic.
Those are scary.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
But
anyway, you won't feel them. These people are out there, and you can do everything correct, and still something can happen. You know, I guess, you know, the guy from Chandler, from Chandler's Wildlife, I think that he's reckless, and he got bit by a cobra. And I think that one was probably preventable, but you know, he's reckless. He got bit by a croc because he was reckless.
He had been just in the yard and such.
No, he was in India when he got bit, but you know, he was trying to get that Cuban crocodile, they in particular, you know, they offered to drain that swamp, so, you know, and then so they could get him. But he wanted to go in while it was, you know, still full of water, and the croc ends up biting him. He ends up in a wheelchair for a year. I wouldn't
believe anybody who offered to drain the swamp either.
Yeah, right. There's other issues there, right? But anyway, and that's what they finally did, is drain the swamp to get this crocodile out, because he was, you know, supposed to be taking it to his place. So there are guys like Chandler that I kind of feel are probably a little reckless, and they do things, you know, for views.
You said he got bit by a cobra.
He did that too. He got bit by both.
He got bit by a cobra, but, you know, the thing about being bitten by a cobra is that if you get fired, that will help you keep your medical coverage.
Anyway, I don't think this guy was doing anything that was reckless necessarily, but there are some people out there that I think are making mistakes that are a bit reckless. So that's my opinion.
But, you know, at the same time, though, how many people are really in a position to tell if somebody is being reckless or not?
I'll show you the video and you can make a decision.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say, a lot of the stuff that Irwin did, he looked like he was being reckless, but he knew exactly what he was doing the whole time.
Anyway, I think that's where we got to end it. Say goodnight, everybody.
Goodnight, everyone.
And that's another neurotoxic venom bite in the UK.
If you've made it this far, that's an hour of your time you're never getting back. But the amateur skeptics appreciate you giving that hour to us. If you'd like to tell us how you felt about spending that hour with us, let us know at WTF@amateurskeptics.com. The Amateur Skeptics Podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons Share Alike No Derivatives 3.5 license. Intro music by Peter Cannell. Find more of Peter's music at soundcloud.com/PKANOL. Exit music by OFM. Find more of their music at myspace.com/OFMHQ. Artwork for the Amateur Skeptics by Sean Smith Ford. Copyright Shadow Knight Digital Portraiture.